I want to thank Rabbi Medlowitz the second time. Hashem, the last machzer, he came and spoke, and it was phenomenal. And then the Hilchos Mezuzah. Once again, his timing is so on target. Mamash, this week we complete Hilchos Mezuzah. Rabbi Medlowitz is here to celebrate with us. And to Mashlim, our limud has been focused on Adinim of Tvias Mezuzah. And Medlowitz is an expert so far, and is a Mechaber Svar, particularly in the area of Hilchos Tam. And it's a big schus to have him speak with us. And without further ado, maybe we'll also hear about the new initiative stamp.
Thank you, Rabbi Cohen. Okay, so it's a pleasure to be here. And so I got off the plane this morning and turned on my phone, and there was an email from Rabbi Cohen, which said the following. Hope you don't mind if I read this out loud. I think the ideal would be a mix of mezuzah-specific issues following a general intro to Safras and global Stam issues, Klaf, Gvil, etc., Aribe, Siesa, Velish, Tsuris, Aesias, etc., etc., Bedika, dot, dot, dot. Plus, perhaps the more common shilas about Tefillin and Sefer Torah, Ribua, various commonly discussed Tidurim, etc. So, I guess that's our topic for today. And I'm assuming you all have about 6 or 7 hours available. Okay, so we'll see what we can do to cover as much of what's on this paper as possible. I guess we'll start with the global Stam issues, Klaf, Gvil, etc., Aribes, Yosef, Elish, Tsuris, Oisius, etc. In terms of global Stam issues, all Stam, by the way, stands for Sifrei Torah, Tefillin, and Mezuzahs. The Mem can also stand for Megillahs, if you so desire, is written on Klaf with Diyoy. Now, in terms of Klaf, Gvil, etc., what's Klaf, what's Gvil, and so forth. So, very briefly, this is a sugya that has thousands of pages written about it in the Rishonim and Achronim, so we'll try and cover it in 4 minutes. When an animal is skinned, we're left with the hide for our purposes. Now, the hide is rather thick and is divided into multiple layers. Those layers are what's known as klaf. Let's back up a step. The klaf in its entirety is known as gvil. Okay, so if you just take the hide off of the animal and you write on that hide, that's what's known as gvil. Today, nobody really writes on gvil except for teimanim, and they still do write on gvil. And when writing on gvil, one writes on the outside of the hide. So if this is the hide, okay, so the inside is the part that's inside, right, with the flesh, and the outside is what you see. So when one is writing a Sefer Torah like the Teimanim on Gvil, one is writing on the outer layer of the hide. Obviously, the hair is removed, but the smooth outer layer is what's written on. Other than Teimanim writing Sefer Torah, nobody else really writes on Gvil nowadays. Everybody writes on what's known as Klaf. Klaf, again, this is a very, very big sugya, but just for the purposes of our brief introduction to what Stam is all about, if this is the hide, so this is the outer layer, this is the inner layer, the kishkas of the animal. So klaf, where we write, is the inside of the outer layer. Okay, so this entire area, the entire inside, which is full of fatty substances and flesh, is scraped away, and all that you're left with is a very thin outer layer. And we write on the inside of the outer layer. So not on the outside where the Teimanim write, but rather we write on the inside over here. And that's what's known as klaf, and that's what all Stam is written on nowadays. Now, there are different types of klaf that are in use. There's what's known as klaf mechona, which means machine klaf, and there's klaf avodas yad. The difference between klaf mechona and klaf avodas yad is as follows. Obviously, in earlier generations, there were no machines, and everything was done by hand. Everything was avodas yad. So the way to process hides for writing stam was that they would take the hide, they would immerse it in a lime solution or some other solution, and that would process the hides. And they would then be fit for writing, and that's what they would write on. With the advent of machinery, so it became much quicker and much easier to process hides. What they would do is, instead of dumping the hides in a solution and every few days having to mix that solution until after about 10 days or so, having them ready for use, with the advent of machinery, so they were able to take, basically, in essence, it's like a washing machine. You have the solution, the lime solution in the machine. You dump the hides in the machine. You say L'shem Kedusha Sefer Torah, or whatever it may be. You push the button, and in half the time, in a couple of days, you can have your hides ready for writing. They're processed and ready for writing. So the question came up in the last 50 years or so, is it preferable to use the machine-made klaf, or is it preferable to use the handmade avodas yad klaf? And the question is, Pesach is coming up now, so we know that about 160 years ago or so, there was a big tumult about machine matzah versus handmade matzah, because again, the machines in the 1860s, maybe it was the late 1850s, I'm not sure, but at that time, the machines, it's the Industrial Revolution, and machinery came into existence, and they had the ability to make matzahs, many, many more matzahs in much less time, by using a machine. Now the problem is, or the shaila is rather, that matzahs have to be made l'shem matzahs mitzvah. So the question is, by pressing a button and saying l'shem matzahs mitzvah, does that achieve the required lishma or not? Now, that at the time was a tremendous, tremendous machlokes, which still goes on until today, whether or not machine matzahs are acceptable for use at the Pesach Seder or not. And it revolves around this issue of lishma. Is doing something by way of electricity, machinery, considered lishma, or is that a chisaron in lishma, and it's perfectly acceptable? So you have the same issue with the hides. If I'm going to dump the hides into a big washing machine, say, l'shem kedusha sefer Torah, push a button, and 3 days later I'm ready to write a sefer Torah, so is that considered as though these hides were processed lishma, which is required, or is that not considered as though the hides were processed lishma, and therefore they'll be unfit for use for stam? Now, for many, many years, the poskim were makel, for the simple reason that the hides produced by machine-made klaf were far superior to the hides available by way of handmade. However, in the past 20 years or so, that has changed, and they've perfected the art of making klaf by hand to a level that's actually equivalent to or even better than the machines. And for that reason, there are many Peskin that say that even though 30, 40, 50 years ago, the minig in the world was to be makel, to use machine-made klaf, but nowadays that it's not necessary to do so, so it would be preferable to use handmade klaf. Amongst the Peskin, there are varying opinions as to the degree of preference for handmade klaf, avodas yad klaf, but suffice it to say that most paiskim, not all, but most paiskim are of the opinion that since the price difference is not that great, it would be ideal, if possible, to use stam made by hand rather than using klaf that is made by machine. Again, if somebody has tefillin or mezuzahs or sefer Torah written on klaf that was made by machine, I'm not here to cast aspersions or say that there's any problem with such klaf. The hachra of the poskim is that it's kosher. I'm just pointing out that if somebody's buying something new and he has the ability to purchase a pair of tefillin, for instance, written on klaf, avodas yad, so that would be preferable. In terms of the the types of writing that there is in Hilchos Stam. So we're all aware that although when we write something, so we're writing in script, as it were, but Stam is written in what's known as Ksav Ashuris. Ksav Ashuris is an elegant, fancy, for lack of a better word, style of writing. And all Sifrei Torah, Tefillin, Mezuzos, Megillas, Nach, are all written with Ksav Ashuris. Now there are various styles of Ksav Ashuris. There's what's known as Ksav Beis Yosef, there's what's known as Ksav Arizal, and there's what's known as Ksav Velish. B'Hashkafa Rishayna, one would think that something that's Ksav Beis Yosef would be the Sephardi Ksav, right? Beis Yosef, all the Sephardim follow the Beis Maran Bet Yosef, and one would think that Ksav Beis Yosef would be the Sephardi Ksav. Surprisingly, that's not the case. Ksav Beis Yosef is actually the Ashkenazi Ksav. Why that is because the Beis Yosef, in his Sefer, Beis Yosef, is matic, he copies a kuntres written by an Ashkenazi Rishon, which describes all the letters of the Aleph Beis. And since that kuntres was written by an Ashkenazi Rishon, and the Beis Yosef copied it, so the minig of all, he was essentially copying the minig of the Ashkenazim. Why he didn't print the minig of the Sephardim is a question that is open for discussion until today, but the fact of the matter is that he didn't, and all Ashkenazi Ksav is what's known as, not all, we'll see in a second, it's not all, but standard Ashkenazi Ksav is what's known as Ksav Beis Yosef. The Arizal, as we know, lived in Tzfas at the same time as the Beis Yosef, and he introduced, al pi Kabbalah, a number of changes to Ksav Beis Yosef. And he recommended changing the style of writing, the Aleph, the Vav, the Ayin, the Pei, the Shin. Some say, I'm sorry, not the Pei, the Ayin, the Shin, the Tzadi, and some say the Ches and the Tes as well. Now the primary change, most of those letters, the change is, for lack of a better word, insignificant. I mean, obviously it is significant because he felt that it should be changed. But for the purposes of, in terms of discussing the kashrus of Ksav, the changes are minor. But when it comes to the letter tzaddik, the change is quite drastic. And I'll make a picture for you so you can see. I'll make a drawing for you so you can actually see the difference between the tzaddik of the Beis Yosef versus the tzaddik of the Arizal. Okay, so that's the Beis Yosef Tzaddik, and that's the Arizal Tzaddik. So what's the difference between them? There are two differences between them. Anyone? Yeah?
One of them is on the left side, and one is the right side.
Okay.
And one of them has a branch, the Beis Yosef has a branch going up.
Okay, so the Beis Yosef one, you'll see, is comprised of a Nun with a Yud on top of it. Okay? The Nun of the Beis Yosef Ksav has what's called the tzavar, the neck of the letter, coming out of the center of the head. And in Ksav Arizal, it's coming out of the right side of the head. That's one difference. That's a minor difference. The primary difference is regarding the yud, which rests on top of the nun. As you see, in Ksav Beis Yosef, the yud is a regular yud. And in Ksav Arizal, it's a backward yud. Okay, so that's the primary difference. Now, in later generations, this change of the Arizal engendered a great tumult as to the kashrus of the letter tzadi. Chaim Kanievsky enumerates in one of his svarim 11 Rishonim who discuss how to write the letter tzadi, and all of them refer to a tzadi with a forward, normal yud, which is understandable because the Arizal was changing the standard. That's exactly what he was doing, right? The question is this a halachic problem? So most Paiskim are of the opinion that the Arizal Tzaddik is not a problem. And if somebody is a regular Ashkenazi and he's wearing the Arizal Tzaddik, his tefillin or his mezuzahs are still kosher. There is, however, a vocal minority opinion in the Achrayinim, led by the Chazon Ish and others, who are of the opinion that for someone who doesn't have the minig to use Ksav Arizal, it would actually not be kosher for him. So who does have the minig to use Ksav Arizal? That would be the Chassidim. The Chassidim follow the minig of the Arizal. So again, we have a division amongst Ashkenazim. Non-Chassidic Ashkenazim use what's known as Ksav Beis Yosef, and Chassidic Ashkenazim use Ksav Arizal. And again, according to most Paiskim, if one has Arizal tefillin or mezuzahs, he can still sleep at night. His tefillin and his mezuzahs are kosher. However, certainly if somebody's buying something new, he should make sure that what he's purchasing is according to his minig. If he's of a Chassidish estak and his minhagim follow Chassidish minhagim, so he should buy Ksav Arizal. If he's of non-Chassidic stack, then he should be sure to purchase only Beis Yosef. The third type of Ksav is what's known as Ksav Velish. Ksav Velish is used by Sfardim, and pretty much all the letters of the Aleph Beis are a little bit different. Most of the differences are just stylistic, they're minor, but Sfardim also use the Arizal Tzaddik. They have a backwards Tzaddik, they also have a different Nun, which is a halachic question. There are a number of differences in a Sfaradi Ksav. The bottom line is, as I said, most Paiskim are of the opinion that all Ksavim are kosher for all Jews. However, all Paiskim also agree that ideally everyone should stick to their own minig and try not to use Stam written according to other minhagim. That's in terms of the various types of lettering that there are. Okay. Now, it says over here, bedika. So I'm assuming, correct me if I'm wrong, that the kavana in bedika is, in terms of checking, one checking their tefillin and mezuzahs. So in terms of checking tefillin and mezuzahs, it's a little bit complicated, and we'll try and break it down as best as we can. We'll start with mezuzahs. It's mefurish in the Gemara that mezuzahs should be checked pamayim bashavua. Pamayim bashavua means twice in 7 years. So first of all, what does pamayim bashavua mean, twice in 7 years? So if I check it once after 6 years and once after 6.5 years, and now I was mekayim the din of checking it pamayim bashavua. So again, Reb Chaim Kanievsky says in one of his svarim that no, the kavana of pamayim bashavua is every 3.5 years. I'll just use the terminology of Pamayim Vashavua, but the Kavana is twice in 7 years. Reb Nissen Karelitz has a revolutionary way of understanding this, and he says it means once in 7 years. I think the general accepted practice is twice in 7 years. And the Velt is not so makbid about this, and the question becomes why. So the answer seems to be as follows. The Gemara says that there are two reasons to check, Rashi says that there are two reasons to check one's mezuzahs. One reason is because it may have decayed, the cloth may have decayed or become, it may have rotted over time. And the second reason is because we want to make sure that the mezuzah is there. Maybe it's not there. So as far as the reason of checking the mezuzah is because maybe they're not there, so l'chayr for that you don't have to check the mezuzah. You can just look and see if it's there, and if it's there, it's there. But in terms of the mezuzah developing mold or rotting or something of that nature, so that raises an interesting discussion amongst contemporary Paiskim. And that is as follows. In ancient times, when Chazal were creating this takana, so they didn't have insulated homes, they didn't have heating, they didn't have air conditioning. It was a different society. The homes had ritivut, right? There was leakage. And there was a real fear and a serious concern that the mezuzah may have become moldy or rotted over time. There are those that want to argue that nowadays this entire takana would not apply because our metzias is a different metzias. If you have a mezuzah here on the wall, what are the odds that it, over time it became moldy or something happened to it? It's in a climate-controlled, atmosphere, and there's no real reason to assume that anything would have happened to it. For that reason, there are paiskim that hold that nowadays there is no chiyuv to check mezuzahs. Now, before we lay out the opposing view, it's important to note, very important to note, that even those that say that nowadays there's no chiyuv to check mezuzah, they're only referring to indoor mezuzahs. But a mezuzah that one has on his front door or on his porch, everybody would agree, would need to be checked twice in 7 years. And that's because the front door mezuzah or the porch mezuzah is exposed to heat, it's exposed to freezing cold temperatures, it's exposed to rain. And as somebody who checks mezuzahs every day, I can assure you that it's extremely common for outdoor mezuzahs to have serious issues. One extreme story, which I can relate, is I live in Ramat Beit Shemesh, which is kind of like living in Arizona. It gets very, very hot. And one of the streets in the neighborhood is exposed to the sun in an extreme manner. And there was somebody who gave me his mezuzahs to check, and he had on his porch a mezuzah which was in a metal case. And when I unscrewed the thing at the bottom, the screw at the bottom, ash came out. There was no zecher of a mezuzah there. The mezuzah had been literally incinerated. Okay? Because he had a metal case exposed to burning sunlight, and the mezuzah just burnt to a crisp. There was no cloth, there was no nothing, there was no shape. It was just ash. It was like lahavdil chas v'shalom. I don't want to use the word, but it was like cremated. It was mamish, there was nothing there. So the point is, outdoor mezuzahs should be checked. I've also checked many, many times where I found outdoor mezuzahs that had severe water damage. They had become pustle because of water, and letters cracking all the time, which could come potentially from cold, right? And imagine if you put a mezuzah in the freezer, right? So, I mean, I'm not a scientist, but it would make sense that the mezuzah would just crack from the cold. Outdoor temperatures in New York City are a lot colder than a freezer, right? A freezer, how cold is a freezer? A freezer is like 30 degrees, right? 29 degrees, regular, if you walk into a freezer, I think that's the normal temperature. I don't think it's like, sub-zero, right? But if you have mezuzahs that are exposed to 10-degree, 20-degree weather, so they certainly can develop cracking letters. Extreme heat can also cause the ink to melt. Sometimes I've seen mezuzahs that were literally sealed shut because the dye, the ink, had melted and it was impossible to open. Also, because of heat, all the moisture in the cloth gets sapped out and it becomes brittle. And you take the mezuzah out of the case. This usually happens in transparent cases, which are exposed to direct sunlight, and the mezuzah just cracks in your hand because there's no moisture left in the mezuzah, and the cloth just becomes like very brittle paper, and the mezuzah just crumbles in your hands. So, again, I can't stress it enough. Even according to the paiskim that hold that nowadays mezuzahs do not need to be checked, that only applies to indoor mezuzahs. Outdoor mezuzahs certainly need to be checked according to all opinions. Now, as far as indoor mezuzahs are concerned, so, as we said, there are paiskim that hold that they don't have to be checked. It's worth noting, however, that it's questionable. I'm not chas v'shalom considering myself to be a bar plukta of some of the G'dayli HaPaiskim who have said such a thing. However, in terms of the metzias is that ink is it's a chemical creation, and over time, ink oxidizes. And what that does is, the Achronim are full of shilas about Sifrei Torah, where the ink has turned from black to red, or rust, a rust color, brownish-reddish hue. And Lamaisa, the metzias is that even on indoor mezuzahs, very often one finds that over time, the mezuzahs do fade. The color fades, And in order for a mezuzah to be kosher, it has to be black. If the mezuzah is not black, the kashrus of the mezuzah can come into question depending on how not black it is. So, again, as somebody who checks mezuzahs on a daily basis, it would seem to me that the metzias is that even indoor mezuzahs, over time, the color can fade, letters can crack as well, and therefore, it would seem to me that one should try and check his mezuzahs, if not twice in 7 years, at least once in 7 years, like Rav Nissim Karelitz, because, as I'm saying, they don't last forever. That's just a fact. By the way, if anyone has any questions, feel free to interrupt. Yes? So
good question. About the brittle and mezuzah that you were talking about?
Yeah.
Would that be possible if it wasn't open?
Yes. The Marasham says, if I'm not mistaken, that a mezuzah or tefillin, you have to be able to read it. It has to be neat in lakriya. And if you're unable to open it, then by definition it's unable to be read, and therefore it would be puzzle even if you would not open it. So yes, that's a good question, and yeah, that would be problematic. Now, in terms of tefillin, so there's a halach in Shulchan Aruch. If I'm not mistaken, it's in Siman Lamed Tes. I think it's Sif Yud Aleph. Over there it says that tefillin shehosaku b'kashrus einan tzricha b'dika la'olam. Tefillin which one knows to have been kosher when he purchased them never have to be checked. Furthermore, there are people in the stam industry who sell tefillin and tell the consumer never check them because opening the tefillin causes problems. It can cause problems to the cloth, it can just unfolding the cloth, the tefillin shel rosh, in order to be inserted into their respective compartments, need to be folded. So they say that by unfolding it to check it, that can cause the letters in the folds to crack, which is true. Okay? It can cause the letters in the folds to crack, which can facilitate your tefillin. So by checking your tefillin, you can be causing more problems than you're helping. So that's one reason they say not to check your tefillin. Another reason they say not to check your tefillin is because it can ruin the batim. The more the batim are open and closed, the more problems can develop in the batim. The opposing view is twofold. In terms of the batim, yeah.
By tefillin, and also I guess by mezuzah, why can we say
so again, the chazaka that you don't have to check it would only apply, for instance, let's say a mikveh, right? The halacha is that a mikveh that you know has 40 sa in it, so you can assume that it has 40 sa in it. But let's say you have a mikveh, I'll give you a perfect example. Let's say you live in Ramat Beit Shemesh and you have a pool for the kids on your porch in the summertime. Right? The fact of the matter is that the water will evaporate due to the heat. So the chazakah only applies so long as there's no reyasa against the chazakah. But if you have a reyasa against the chazakah, so then the chazakah is problematic. It's difficult to rely on a chazakah when you have a reason to assume that there is no chazakah. So that's what's going on over here. In terms of tefillin, you have the same taina that we mentioned by mezuzah, you have the same taina by tefillin also. Parashiyas, the ksav and the parashiyas does fade. Again, I check tefillin every day, and I can tell you 100%. I mean, it's very simple, okay? If you take right now 100 pairs of tefillin that were written 100 years ago, and you open them up and you look at the parashiyas, you will find that 99 out of 100 are not going to be kosher. Why? Because the ksav has faded and it's no longer black. Which means that at some point in the last 100 years, it may have been 80 years ago, it may have been 50 years ago, it may have been yesterday, it's difficult to know when it happened, but at some point over the last 100 years, this ink crossed the line from being kosher to being unkosher. Which means that if somebody here is 20 years old and he got his tefillin 7 years ago, at some point in the next 100 years, his tefillin are going to become unkosher, which would mean that l'chayr it's a davar pashut that one does have to check his tefillin. Ayin Mechaber says that you don't have to check your tefillin. So the answer to that question would seem to be that the Mechaber was dealing with a type of ink which does not fade. The Rambam, when he discusses how to make ink, the Rambam gives his recipe for making ink, and the Rambam says that it'll last, I think the Lashon is, if I'm not mistaken, la'alfei shanim, for thousands of years. Indeed, if you take a look at a newspaper printed 100 or 200 years ago, you'll see that the ksav is still black. And the reason is because the ink used in newspapers is the same ink, it has the same base that the Rambam was using, and that's carbon. Carbon stays black forever. However, the ink that's used nowadays, and the ink that's been used for hundreds of years, is not a carbon-based ink, it's an iron-based ink, and the iron-based ink does fade over time. Which leads to the question, why don't we just use the Rambam's carbon-based ink? And the answer may surprise you, and that is that they have not been able to recreate the Rambam's recipe successfully. Even in the year 2023, they have not been able to produce a carbon-based ink for Seferim which works well, and which doesn't crack, and which doesn't become brittle, and they have not cracked the code. It's like my wife's grandmother had this recipe for minute steaks. It was amazing. And she passed away, and nobody's been able to duplicate it, even though she gave the recipe. But obviously there was some secret ingredient that she didn't give over, and they just can't do it. So the Rambam's diyei, lahavdil, it's the Mishnah Berurah writes. It's Mefurish in the Mishnah Berurah. He quotes the Birka Yosef, who says that we've been unable to reproduce this ink in a manner that would make it usable. They're working on it, but thus far with limited success. So we use the iron-based ink, and the iron-based ink does fade. So therefore, as far as the taina of not checking the parashiyos, it would seem to me that one definitely does have to check the parashiyos. As far as the issue of the cracking letters in the folds, what am I supposed to do? I acknowledge that unfurling the tefillin can create a psul in the letters in the folds, but at the same time, if you don't check the tefillin, you could have much bigger problems on your hands. So therefore, I would think that one should check the tefillin. Yeah. So that's a very good question. I was waiting for someone to ask that question. There are two possible answers. One is that you're right, and ein hachinami. If when you're going to unfold it, it's going to crack, so maybe it's not kosher already now, which means that certainly you have nothing to lose by checking them because they weren't kosher anyway. That's one possibility. The counter argument would be that since over there there's a physical act that you're doing which is ruining the letter. In other words, when I have a mezuzah which is rolled up and it's from the heat, the ink is stuck to the back. So over there, it's not the pshat that I'm doing an act which is puzzling the mezuzah. The mezuzah is puzzle. Masha'enkein, the tefillin, when they're folded up in their compartment, they're not puzzle, they're fine. I'm now physically ruining them. So perhaps that would be different. So that would be their taina not to check the tefillin, but again, counter-argument is that since the ink is going to fade, at some point, they have to be checked. There's no way to get around it.
Do you have a sense, based on your experience, is there a curve data around how long does it take for...
So, yes. First of all, I'll quote the Aruch HaShulchan. The Aruch HaShulchan, I didn't invent this. This is not Reuven Mendelowitz's invention. This is already mentioned by a number of Achreinim. The Yaivitz mentions this, the Chayyadim mentions this, the Melech HaShemayim mentions this. The Tshuva Me'ava mentions this. This is well known for hundreds of years. So it's not my chiddush. So then the question becomes, as Rabbi Cohen just brought up, so how often should you check your tefillin? If we're going to say that the mitzias of the mechaber no longer applies, how often should you check your tefillin? Before we answer that question, let's just go back 1 second to the batim. As far as the argument that checking the tefillin is going to ruin the batim, that is just, I mean, to my mind, it's just not accurate. Any decent pair of batim can be opened and closed multiple times, and it's not going to ruin the batim. I don't find that to be a convincing argument at all. It's just, I don't think it's factually correct. So that leads us back to the question of how often should one check the tefillin. The Aruch HaShulchan also raises these issues, and I'm a fan of his formulation. The Aruch HaShulchan says, based on all of the above, Nira, that one should check the tefillin, Be'ezezman. Be'ezezman, I would translate into English as meaning once in a while. Okay, so now let's try and narrow down what's once in a while. So this is a number that I'm totally making up. There's no basis for it, but it would seem to me to be a reasonable number. I would say Be'erech, once every 12 years or so, somebody should check the tefillin just to make sure that the letters haven't faded, that the ribua is still the way it's meant to be, that everything is as it should be. That's what I mean. There is a well-known minhag to check one's tefillin before they get married, which certainly is advisable. I heard recently a nice biur for the shayrish of this minhag. I don't know if it's accurate or not, but it sounds good, so I think we could go with it. And that is that it's brought down that a chassan shehailech l'chupasai, so is mechaprin lo al kol avinoisav. Right? So when a person gets married, so he wakes up the next morning with a clean slate. Okay, he's a new person, and he's starting a new life, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is giving him a clean slate. Great. So he wakes up, he has this new life ahead of him, clean slate, and he makes right away a bracha levatola shelaniach tefillin. Then he makes another bracha levatola al mitzvah tefillin, right? So it's a bad idea to start off this married life of a clean slate with unkosher tefillin. So therefore, the minhag became to check one's tefillin before they get married, because that way, when you're starting off your new life and your clean slate, you're starting off with mitzvahs being done properly the way they're meant to be done. So again, I don't know if that's the actual sharish of the minhag, but I think it sounds good, and it's a nice minhag. I'll just throw in, what about Sifrei Torah? You had a question? No? As far as Sifrei Torah are concerned, what about checking Sifrei Torah? It's a largely ignored subject. I think people don't really check Sifrei Torah, but perhaps they should, because, again, my wife's grandfather, he was the gabbai of the shul in Flatbush, and like many shuls, as the years go by, the members are no longer counted amongst the living. And he was the last surviving member of the shul. And it was written in the shul's constitution that the last surviving member of the shul gets to take a Sefer Torah. That was what it said. So he was the last surviving member of the shul. So he took me to the shul, and there were 13 Sefer Torah in the Aron Kodesh. The youngest of those Sifrei Torah was probably 50 or 60 years old. And I looked through all 13 of them, and I told him that I'm sorry to say, but I would just put all 13 into Gniza. None of them were kosher anymore. So therefore, to try and avoid this issue, it would seem to me that shuls and Rabbanim of shuls should have their Sifrei Torah checked. Again, I'm making up a number, say once every 20 years or so. I think it would be kedai to have the Sifrei Torah in a shul check. Yeah.
If the Sifrei Torah is in use, then as long as the Baal Kari somewhat knows what they're doing, wouldn't it just inherently get checked?
One would think so, but two points. Number one, it seems that it's not always the case. That's number one. Number two, in terms of letters which are fading or cracking, those things are not necessarily always going to be noticed by a Baal Kari. In other words, it takes the havchana of an expert sometimes to determine if this is a color, just like other areas of halacha. A person has to know which color is this considered red, is this considered black, is this considered brown, what color is this, right? So here too, I need black, but is this black or is this not black? So sometimes you need an expert to determine if this is still considered to be black or not. Also, in terms of letters which are cracking, which can certainly happen over time, and a Baal Kari may not notice a slight crack, whereas a Magia, who checks Tefillin, Sifrei Torah, Mezuzos all the time, so he sees these cracks, that's what he does. He catches them right away. I've seen hundreds of times where a Magia, whether it's myself or somebody else, will look at something for a split second, and right away he'll say, look, this letter is cracked. And people who've been looking at it for, an hour didn't even notice it. So it's lav dafka that a balkari will always catch all of those things. So again, I would think that it would be kedai to check sefer Torah. Again, I'm making up a number, but I would think every 20 years or so, it's probably a good idea.
You say about 12-year estimation.
Yeah.
12 years for spelling. So would that apply to mezuzahs also?
No, so mezuzahs is different because mezuzahs, we have a takana from Chazal that says to check it twice in 7 years. These other paiskim are coming to be mevatel the takana of Chazal. So in as much as their arguments are questionable, so l'chayr we revert back to the original takana of Chazal. Now, it is true that the Chayyadam that I mentioned before, he says one should check the tefillin twice in 7 years also. I'm not the bar plukta of the Chayyadam, but l'chayr that's a little bit shver, because Chazal never made a takana to check tefillin twice in 7 years. L'chayr, if we see that there are problems with tefillin, so then you have the Aruch HaShulchan, you should check it be'ez hazman. But mechit teisi, to transplant the din that was said by mezuzahs to tefillin, maybe there's some difference over there. I don't know. I'm saying the Chayyadim felt that way, and if someone wants to do that, that's fine.
If you felt so, the interior, modern interior mezuzahs to tefillin, to check them. So if you say, but there's bismanazeh, and we have the ink issues.
There's room for such an argument. I'm asking. It's not. Saying there's no hechreach, but yeah, it's definitely Chayyadim felt that way. So yeah, you're in good company. Okay, what else do we have here? Mezuzah specific issues. Okay, you want stam mezuzah specific issues or stam mezuzah specific issues? Not placement.
Okay.
Okay, fine. Okay, so in Reish Peches, one issue, which is an interesting issue, it's a little bit technical. I'll try and cover it as thoroughly as I can in this brief setting, is what's known as the Shir Parsha. The Shir Parsha means as follows. If you look in a Sefer Torah, if you look in a Chumash, you'll see that throughout the Chumash, here and there, you have a pei or a samach. What's that pei and samach doing there? Does anybody know? Yeah? Very good. Right? The pei stands for a parsha psucha, and the samach stands for a parsha stuma. So what is a parsha psucha and what is a parsha stuma? So it means as follows. A sefer Torah is comprised of paragraphs, to use our terminology. Okay, so how do I know where one paragraph ends and the next paragraph starts? Maybe the entire Sefer Torah is just one run-on paragraph. So for that, we have the advent of Parshias Psuchas and Stumas, right? Parshias Psuchas and Stumas lets us know that this is where a new paragraph begins. Fine. So what's the difference between the two types of paragraphs, a Parsha Psucha versus a Parsha Stuma? So just on a technical level, what it means is, the Marshal quotes a Teres Kayanim, who says that a Parsha Psucha literally means open. Stuma means closed. So what does it mean if a paragraph is closed versus a paragraph that's open? So the Teres Kayanim explains that a Parsha Stuma is still connected to the previous Parsha. Right, so it's like Lahavdil, if you have a secular book, right? So you have chapters and you have paragraphs. So all the paragraphs within a particular chapter are related, they're just separate paragraphs. However, each chapter is a new chapter. So Parsha Psucha, Lahavdil, is like a new chapter. It's a new discussion, a new topic. A Parsha Stuma is like a new paragraph within a chapter. So it's a hemshech of the previous inyan, it's just a new paragraph. Now, in terms of how in a Torah scroll, Parshias Psuchas and Stumas look, is a subject of tremendous, tremendous machlekes amongst the Rishayim, most prominently, the Rambam and the Rush. The Rambam and the Rush give multiple variations of how a Parsha Psucha and how a Parsha Stuma are meant to be written in a Sefer Torah. It happens to be that there's one version of a Parsha Psucha and one version of a Parsha Stuma which the Rambam and the Rosh agree on. So although the other variations that they give do not work with each other, it's a machlekes, but one version of the Psucha and one version of the Stuma, the Rambam and the Rosh agree is a Psucha and is a Stuma. Okay, so I'll draw it out for you. This is a parsha, sorry, and I did it wrong. See that? If you have a paragraph, then you have writing until here, and you have 9 letters worth of space empty until the end of the line, and then you have a new paragraph beginning over here. So this is a parsha psucha, which is good according to the Rambam and the Rosh. Okay? If you have writing which ends in the middle of the line, 9 letters worth of empty space, followed by writing continuing at the end of the line, that's a parsha stuma, which is good according to the Rambam and the Rosh. So if you look in our Sefer Torah, you'll see that all of the parshias, psuchas, and stumais are arranged in that manner. Okay? Problem becomes when you get to tefillin, okay? And we'll get to mezuzah in a second. When you get to tefillin, you have a problem. What's the problem? The problem is it's actually 7 lines, and a Shel Reish it's 4 lines, but you have 4 parshias. Okay? You have Kaddish, you have Bahaya Kiyav Yacha, you have Shema, and you have Bahaya and Shemaya. Now, the parsha Stuma, that's kosher according to everybody, cannot be reproduced in a pair of tefillin, because between these parashias are psuchas. So psucha is no problem. You write Kaddish until there, you leave the rest of the line blank, you start Vahaya Kiviyacha, it's a psucha. The last line of Vahaya Kiviyacha you write until there, you leave the rest blank, Shema is a psucha. So far life is terrific. You have a kosher Kaddish, Vahaya Kiviyacha, and Shema according to the Rambam and the Rosh. Okay, because they're supposed to be psuchas. But between Shema and Vahayim Shemaya, you're meant to have a stuma. Now, how can you possibly recreate a stuma, which is kosher according to everybody, when they're on different columns? It can't be done. So, how do we deal with this issue? So the Mechaber says, we can't deal with the issue, and since we can't deal with the issue, since the Haskamas HaRishayim is that the Halacha is like the Rambam, so Mamela, just do it like the Rambam. Okay? So you leave the beginning blank, you start over there, and that's how it's meant to look according to the Mechaber. Okay? Along came the Taz, and it really wasn't the Taz. Before the Taz, you have the Marshal. Taz actually even quotes the Marshal, and there's a Maram Padva who also preceded the Taz, and they say that no, there is an Eitza of how it can be done. What's that Eitzah? If you leave a little bit of blank space at the end of Shema, let's say, for argument's sake, five letters worth of space, and you leave five letters worth of space at the beginning of Vayam Shemaya, okay? So he employs a concept that's known as tziruf. Tziruf means that we're mitzaref, we join together the empty space at the end of this line, the empty space at the beginning of this line, and it's as though you have that Parshas Tumah over there, which would be kosher according to the Rambam and the Rush. That's the Eitzah of the Taz. Now, the Eitzah of the Taz is accepted by almost all Achrayinim. Almost all Achrayinim accept the Eitzah of the Taz, and that includes, as we said, the Maran Padva, the Marshal, the Taz himself, the Gra, the Aruch HaShulchan, the Chazinish, the Mikdash Ma'at, the Das Kedoshim, Neid B'Yehuda, Chassam Sofer, Rebbe Akiva Eiger, many, many Achrayinim endorse the Eitzah of the Taz. The Lashon of the Chassam Sofer is that the Divrei HaTaz, Divrei Elikim Chayim. The Lashon of the Aruch HaShulchan and the Das Kedoshim, I believe, and the Beis Shlema, I think also, is Kfar Nispashtu, Kedivrei HaTaz, B'Kol Medina Seinu. The Minig is like the Taz. So, again, we mentioned before that the Beis Yosef says that this conundrum cannot be resolved, and therefore we have to do like the Rambam. So the Sfaradim say, well, if the Beis Yosef said, Maran Bet Yosef said that this issue can't be resolved, and therefore he says to do like the Rambam, so obviously he thought of the Eitzah of the Taz, he didn't approve of it, he felt that this idea of Tziruf does not work, and such a parasha would be puzzle for Sfaradim. This opinion is the opinion of Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, Rabbi Tzina Abashol, and many Sfaradi Paiskim. They say that since Maran Bet Yosef clearly disagreed with the Taz, therefore, if a Sfaradi, this is a tremendous, tremendous nafkamina la'alacha, if you have a Sfaradi boy here in Yeshiva who left his tefillin at home one day, and he wants to borrow a pair of tefillin from one of his friends, according to the Sfaradi Paiskim, it would be a bracha levatola, because most Ashkenazi tefillin are written like the Taz, and for a Sfaradi to make a bracha on Parshias written like the Taz is a bracha levatola according to them. That's what they say. Others argue, even amongst the Sfaradim, and they say there are two potential arguments to that. Number one is, even if the Beis Yosef held that way, but Lamaisa, I'm saying, you have dozens of Achrayinim that hold that it's kosher. So, to what degree? So there is a Lashon of Avadia quotes, I think, Afilu neged elef poiskim, Afilu im kola oilam kula, I would say, against the Beis Yosef, we don't care, Beis Yosef, that's it. Okay, not all Sfaradi poiskim agree to that. They say that if Rubam kukulam of the Achrayinim hold that it's kosher, so to say it's a Baruch Levatola is a bit extreme, and it would be kosher. That's one argument. A second argument is that Lamaisa, the Beis Yosef doesn't say anywhere that Tziruf is possible. Beis Yosef just doesn't mention Tziruf. And he says to do like the Rambam. If you look in Hilchas Mezuzah, in Resh Peches, you'll find, in Resh Pehe actually, I think it is, in Resh Ayin Hei, in Hilchas Sefer Torah, where the Beis Yosef discusses the Parshias, but it's in Resh Peches also. He quotes the Rush, and the Rush himself seems to endorse Tziruf. The Beis Yosef also quotes a Smag, where it's debatable how to understand the Smag, but there's room to understand the Smag as well that Tziruf would work. So for that reason, there are those that say that since you do find in Hilchas Mezuzah that the Beis Yosef seems to acknowledge the Shita of Tziruf, of course the Rush says it black and white. In fact, the Gra in Hilchas Tefillin, where he endorses the Taz, he says, how can you say that the Taz is wrong? the Rosh in Hilchas Mezuzah clearly says like the Taz. So Mimela, they say that you can't say that the Beis Yosef held this pasul. Why didn't he bring that in Hilchas Tefillin is a kasha, which we don't have a teretz to, but to say that it's a psul when he himself quotes it in Hilchas Mezuzah is difficult to say that it's a psul. So whether a Sfaradi can make a bracha on Tefillin of an Ashkenazi, I'm certainly not going to be the one to decide, but he should ask a shayla. Yeah.
How did the Rishon write in there, though?
I guess the Rambam wrote like the Rambam, and the Rosh wrote like the Rosh. There's also a shita of the Masechah Seifrim. Rabbeinu Tam seems to have gone with the Masechah Seifrim. There's a Yerushalmi. Apparently, there were many different minhagim. If you look at the Marshal, has a massive, massive tshuva, a humongous tshuva, Simen Lamed Zayin and Tshuva's Marshal, where he goes through enormous arichas. He brings tshuvas from different contemporaries of his, and it seems like they were varying minhagim. It seems like there was no clear cut minig. Now, the reason for this whole debate by Hilchas Tefillin is because the halacha is that if one makes the last parasha in Tefillin like a psucha, the Tefillin are going to be pasul. Okay, so you got to get it right. You need a stuma, that's a stuma. So when we're doing like the Taz, it's because we hold that the Taz is right. Okay, because if he's wrong, we're cooked. We're not Mekayim Mitzvah's Tefillin. Either we don't have a Shir Parsha at all, or if you do like the Mechaber wants you to do, so then you have a Psucha according to the Rosh. According to the Rosh, that would be Pasul. Now it's true, we do Paskin like the Rambam. So Lamaisa, the bottom line is, by Tefillin, let's get to the bottom line. All Sfaradim do like the Rambam. Amongst Ashkenazim, the vast majority of Ashkenazim, I don't know what the number is, 90, 95%, something like that, do like the Taz. There is a miut of Ashkenazim that also do like the Rambam. The Soloveitchiks do like the Rambam, and Rav Scheinberg held that it's better to do like the Rambam. There are those that do like the Rambam because they're scared to do like the Taz. But Lamaisa, like I'm saying, the vast, vast majority of Ashkenazim are noyig like the Taz when it comes to Hilchas, when it comes to Tefillin. Now, one other point that's important to mention is that aside from the fact that the Rosh in Hilchas Mezuzah seems to endorse the Shita of the Taz, the Rambam himself, when he enumerates the three ways that one can create a Stuma, the third way of the Rambam, I believe it's the third way, maybe it's the second, I don't remember, I think it's the third, seems to be the Taz. So not only did the Taz not invent his Shita, but seemingly the Rosh in Hilchas Mezuzah and the Rambam in Hilchas Tefillin both actually seem to say like the Taz. What's the Nafkamina? The Nafkamina would be for a Teimani. I once got a phone call from a Teimani, and he told me that his tefillin got lost or whatever, and he needs to borrow a pair of tefillin from a gemach. Is it mutter for him to use Ashkenazi tefillin? And his question was, he was asking, how's the ksav? So the ksav, I told him, is not a problem. Certainly you can use the ksav beis yosef, like we said before. Ksav beis yosef, of all three ksavim, ksav beis yosef is the only one that's for sure kosher according to everybody. So he can certainly wear tefillin with ksav beis yosef. But I told him, what you really should be asking is about the Shir Parsha. Because if Teimanim, you know, a lot of people think Teimanim are like Sfaradim. If Sfaradim hold you can't make a bracha on tefillin that are written according to the Taz, so maybe Teimanim also shouldn't be able to make a bracha on tefillin written according to the Taz. But I told him that L'chaira would not be a problem because, like I'm saying, one of the ways, again, it's either the second or the third way that the Rambam quotes of how to make a stuma seems to be the Taz. So I told him, L'chaira, if that's the case, then even you as a Teimani who do everything like the Rambam, you'd be able to wear Ashkenazi tefillin, because even though the Shir Parsha is like the Taz, the Pashtus is that according to the Rambam, that should be fine. To double check, I called Rabbi Yitzchak Ratzabi. Rabbi Yitzchak Ratzabi is a Teimani Rav who lives in Bnei Brak. He's certainly the biggest mumch in Hilchas Stam amongst Teimanim, that's for sure. But even putting Teimanim on the side, he's one of the biggest mumchim in Hilchas Stam in the world. He's a tremendous, tremendous mumch in Hilchas Stam. And I called him up and I asked him, and he said to me, Betach, ein shum bayah. If Lafia Rambam, Taz Beseder. So a Taimani would be able to borrow tefillin from an Ashkenazi. Yeah.
So what compelled the other Sephardi poskim to say that you're not allowed to make a bracha? Why didn't they rely on that Rambam?
Great question. I wish I knew. It would seem that L'chaira, again, Rabbi Avad Yosef and Rabbi Zina Mishal say otherwise, but it's difficult to understand. L'chaira shouldn't be a problem. I'm saying, well, they're going to say that regardless of the Rambam, once the Beis Yosef doesn't bring it, so it's out. But L'maisa, again, it seems to be that the Rambam seems to say that L'hedya. Okay, so that's regarding tefillin. Now, what about mezuzah? So mezuzah is very interesting. Mezuzah, the Gemara says Lahedya, that although by mezuzah, the parsha by mezuzah you only have Shema and Vahayim Shemaya. You don't have Kadesh and Vahayaki Viacha. So the only sheer parsha that you're dealing with in Hilchas Mezuzah is between Shema and Vahayim Shemaya. Now, as we said, between Shema and Vahayim Shemaya, you need a stuma. Now, by mezuzah, it's not set up side by side. You don't have Shema over here and Vahayim Shemaya over here. By mezuzah, it's all one column. Okay, so when you're making it in one column, how are you going to make a parsha? How are you going to create the stuma between Shema and Vahayim Shemaya? So according to the Beis Yosef and Rabbi Avad Yosef and Rabbi Zion Abishal, you'll just make a regular Rambam. Okay, so you'll write Shema until the end of the line. And you'll start Vahayim Shemaya in the middle of the line. That'll be a regular Rambam parasha, and that's how you'll write the mezuzah. You have a stuma according to the Rambam. Ashkenazim, again, employ the Eitzah of the Taz, meaning that they leave, let's say, five letters worth of, I mean, it's more than five, usually leave seven, whatever, but you leave, let's say, five letters worth of space at the beginning of the Hayam Shemaya. You'll leave five letters worth of space at the end of Shema, and Al Yaday Tziruf, again, you'll have a Parsha Stuma. Okay, so that's how, again, most Ashkenazim write a mezuzah. Yeah?
Why not just do it in Torah?
Why not? Because we have a Kabbalah. That's a good question. The answer is because we have a Kabbalah that what the last letter and first letter on each line of the mezuzah is. And according to that Kabbalah, Uvisharecha is the last word on that line, and Vahaya is the first word on that line. So therefore, this Mesiris HaSeifrim forces us to start Vahayim Shemaya on a new line. So once we're forced by this Messiah to start Vahayim Shemaya on a new line, we're back to the question, how can I create a stuma that's kosher according to everyone? So again, the Sfaradim will say that you can't, and the Ashkenazim will do like the Taz. Yeah.
What's the source for that? Sorry.
It's brought already in the Torah. It's hundreds of years old. So it seems to go way back. Now, the thing about mezuzah, which is different than tefillin, is the following. We said before that by tefillin, if you make the parsha a parsha psucha, it's going to be pasul. Okay? But the Gemara says lahedya that although by mezuzah the parsha is meant to be a stuma, if you make it a psucha, it's kosher. It's mefurish in the Gemara. So memela, there are those amongst the Ashkenazim that say that if that's the case, then you're better off making your parsha like the Sfaradim. Because if you make your parsha like the Sfaradim, so then you have a mehudar parsha according to the Beis Yosef, you have a mehudar Rambam Stuma according to the Beis Yosef. According to the Rush, this is a psucha. The Gemara says a psucha is kosher. So over here by tefillin, I have to make myself crazy to try and be Mekayim, the Rambam, and the Rush, because I have to have a stuma. But by mezuzah, where I can have a psucha, so I don't have that issue. And therefore, I'm able to create a parsha stuma without having to rely on the Taz, right? This whole thing comes from the fear of the Taz. The Taz is like walking a tightrope, right? Because if you make it across the falls, you're a hero. But if you fall, you're in bad shape, right? So that's the Taz. If the Taz works, you have a Mahoder Parsha according to Kuli Alma, you're a hero. But if the Taz doesn't work, if Tziruf doesn't work, there is a Meiri, by the way, that says black on white that Tziruf does not work. So if Tziruf does not work, then you haven't got a Shir Parsha at all. If you haven't got a Shir Parsha at all, then it's puzzle. So for that reason, there are those that say that by mezuzah, you're actually better off making the parasha like the Rambam, like the Beis Yosef, rather than doing the Taz. However, Lamaisa the Minig by most Ashkenazim is to make the mezuzah like the Taz anyway. And the reason for that is twofold. Number one, because as we said before, there are dozens of Achrenim who say that the Taz is correct, including, again, Rabbi Kiva Eger, the Chassam Sofer, and the Neid of Yehuda. So, if it's correct, it's correct. And you just do like the Taz. You don't have to go like this to do things differently. That's reason number one. Reason number two for Ashkenazim is because there's a Shulchan Aruch HaRav. Shulchan Aruch HaRav, he says also that the Taz does not work. And if somebody makes tefillin like the Taz, his tefillin are apostle. So in Chabad, obviously, they don't do their tefillin like the Taz because of this, because of the Shulchan Aruch HaRav. So, by mezuzah, there's a Shulchan Aruch HaRav that says that you don't need a Shir Parasha at all. So in Mela, there are those that say that if by tefillin, the whole reason why I'm not doing the Taz is because I'm scared that I'm not Yoytzi, because the Shulchan Aruch HaRav says that I'm not Yoytzi. By mezuzah, the Shulchan Aruch HaRav says I don't need a Shir Parasha at all. So even if the Taz doesn't work, it's still okay. So Mimela is less concerned by mezuzah to do like the Taz. In fact, Rav David Yosef writes in his Sefer Halacha Brura that even a Sephardi can use an Ashkenazi mezuzah because it's not muchrach that you need a Shir Parasha at all. There's a Rabbeinu Yeshaya, one of the Rishonim, who seems to say that you don't need a Shir Parasha, and the Shulchan Aruch HaRav says that you don't need a Shir Parasha. And that aforementioned smag that we spoke about, which is mentioned in the Beis Yosef, may also indicate that you don't need a Shir Parasha. So therefore, although a Sephardi cannot make a bracha, according to those Paiskim at least, on Ashkenazi tefillin, but a Sephardi would be able to use an Ashkenazi mezuzah. And for that reason, there are many that say that there's no reason to make the Ashkenazi mezuzah like the Beis Yosef. If you can make an Ashkenazi mezuzah like the Taz, and the Yotze according to all those Achrenim, and even according to the naysayers, by mezuzah, it's not such a problem.
Are the two sheets connected to each other?
Well, it's in the same tshuva. It's a tshuva in the Kuntra Sachrin at the back of the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, and they're both mentioned in the same discussion, but they're not necessarily related, no. So that's an interesting Hilchestam, Resh Peches aspect of Hilchas Mezuzah. Okay, so I see that we're running out of time a little, so I'll open up the floor if anybody has any questions related to anything Stam related, can feel free to ask. Yeah?
What's the purpose of the Shekhaya on the outside of the Mezuzah facing into the doorway?
That's a very interesting question. The Shekhaya, so I think the Shach brings down that it stands for Shemer Dalsis Yisrael. And it's a Shem Hashem, which apparently scares away Shadim. So we all know that mezuzah provides protection to the home. How so? So Rabbi Shechter is famous for saying that all mitzvahs provide protection, and there are certainly many makaris for that. And he's not so excited about this whole business of the mezuzah being a shmirah. But most people are mesiachis to mezuzah as being a shmirah, and people get even a little neurotic about it. People who have tzaras, they check their mezuzahs. It's a well-established custom for hundreds of years, and I have a lot of good stories with that also. But the mezuzah is a shmirah. So the shakai is the implement. I mean, it could be the mezuzah itself is the implement which scares away the shadim, but it's brought down in the Sfarim that when the Shadim see the Shakai, that's what scares them away. Which leads to an interesting question. what if somebody's using an opaque case? If you have a transparent case, so then, yeah, the Shadim see the mezuzah. But if you have an opaque case, then maybe the Shadim don't see the Shakai, and they can get in. So others say that, no, that the Shadim have x-ray vision. They can see through opaque cases as well. And it wouldn't be a problem. It's also negea because the mezuzah, another Reish Peches issue, is the margin to the right of the mezuzah. It's brought down that the mezuzah should have a margin on the right, which is large enough to cover the entire mezuzah, which raises an interesting question. If you're covering the entire mezuzah, then by definition, you're going to be covering the shakai as well. So what about scaring away the shadim? So one approach is, like we said before, that it scares away the shadim anyway. They can see through it, and it scares them away. And others say that, no, it's brought in Rishonim already. Our guy Maimoni already says you should cut a hole in the klaf so that the shadim can see the shakai and be scared away. It's brought also in that the mezuzah cases, it's brought not to, when you kiss the mezuzah, not to kiss the makam of the shakai, because since there's a hole in the case, you're going to rub out the shakai and it's going to be mechikas Hashem. So today, our cases don't have that problem, but you see that there is an inyan to have a transparent case. But with that said, if somebody has little children at home and he's changing diapers or something like that, so then it's advisable not to have a transparent case. It's covered over the mezuzah, and one should rather use an opaque case for not to come into a situation where it's going to be a bizayin for the mezuzah. I once had an interesting shaila. Someone once called me and asked, a Sephardi Israeli lady called, and she was in a panic because she had an elderly mother, and unfortunately the mother had to be changed in the room. She wasn't able to use the bathroom herself, and the lady called in a panic that she has a picture of the Baba Sali on the wall. So is it mutter to take care of her mother's needs when there's a picture of the Baba Sali on the wall? So I told her it's a very good question, but you have to realize that it's also a question about the mezuzah. If there's a mezuzah, then you're also getting into a question, right? So again, if somebody has little children at home who run around unclothed or they're changed or whatever it is, generally speaking, in a home, let's just say it in one sentence. Generally speaking, a home with little children should use opaque cases. Furthermore, like we said before, for outdoor mezuzahs, which are exposed to direct sunlight, certainly one should use opaque cases, which are not made of metal. Okay? Ideal would be to use either wood or a white lucite type of material or something like that. Yeah?
Besides for the shmir aspect or the cover, what's the best mezuzah case person
choose? The best mezuzah cases are, they make these lucite cases, they make them transparent and white, which have a rubber plug at the bottom. The mila of those cases is twofold. Number one, they're not 100% waterproof, but they're 99% waterproof. And mila number two is that they have a wide halal. The inside of the case is much larger than other mezuzah cases. Most of the mezuzah cases that have a screw at the bottom, which you unscrew, generally have very narrow interiors, and that causes one to have to roll the mezuzah very tightly or to shtup it in to try and get it in, and that can kill the mezuzah. Can certainly scrape off the shakai, that's for sure. And therefore, it's not advisable to use a mezuzah case that has a screw on the bottom, because usually, like I'm saying, they're either made of metal or there is a al pi kabbal an inyan not to use metal, okay, but that the belt is not makbid for that. But the mezuzahs generally have to be wrapped very tightly, which is not healthy. So those lucite cases with the rubber plug at the bottom, I found to be the best cases. Yeah.
We're learning now that if you sell your house to Hayyid, that you have to leave out the mezuzah. So how would that then work exactly if you're selling to someone who holds a different meaning, let's say a Sephardi with a different mezuzah?
Okay, that's a good question. So the answer is as follows: that the din of leaving up the mezuzah, although it's related to the person who's coming in after you, but essentially it's a din, it's bein adam la'atzmai. In other words, your chiyuv, although the shayrish of the din is toward him, But be'etzem, the din is a din bein adam la'atzma. You have to, you may not leave a home without mezuzahs. Okay? You have to leave the home with mezuzahs there. So in Mela, it's not relevant whether the incoming tenant or buyer has the same minig as you or a different minig as you. You're not transferring your mezuzahs to him. You're just keeping your mezuzahs in the house when you leave. Now, incidentally, so that's as far as that's concerned. So if he has a different minig, it doesn't make a difference. Now, incidentally, it's important to note that the Pesukim say that when you leave the mezuzahs, that doesn't mean that he now becomes the owner of those mezuzahs. He has to return them to you. Okay, so if you move out on March 25th, and he's moving in April 1st, okay, so when he moves in on April 1st, he has two choices. Either al pi halach, he's mechuyev to pay you for those mezuzahs, or he's mechuyev to take them down, return them to you, and then put up his own mezuzahs. So that's just a sidebar. Now, if the home is being sold to him, then there are some paiskim that say that the mezuzahs are included in the sale. That's already a chayshin mishpat shayla, whether the mezuzahs are included in the sale or not. But be'etzem, al pi ikar, takana, he doesn't become the owner of the mezuzahs. He has to either give them back to you or pay you for them. Yeah?
Is it too fast in shayla? By tefillin shel yad, you have the feather. Is that ma'akev? Also, the cover for the tefillin, I've heard that's not ma'akev, but how much would it be a priority?
Again, what was the first one? By the tefillin shel yad, you have
like
the...
Like a feather thing that sticks out?
So that's by the shel rosh, not by the shel yad. So by the shel rosh, so it's cyrus, it's hairs of an animal, which when, let's back up a step. When the parashias, each of the four parashias are inserted into their respective compartments, they're wrapped in a cloth, and they're wound with cyrus. Okay, so you usually take from the tail of the animal. I once flew to America from Eretz Yisrael, and I brought with me 7 animal tails, cyrus, for people in Lakewood that needed them. And naturally, they lost my luggage. So after a few days, I got a call from American Airlines, and the lady says to me, we may have found your luggage. Do you give us permission to open it up to determine whether it's yours or not? So I said, sure. So she said, well, what's in there? So I said, 7 cow tails. So she's like, no, really, what's in there? I said, 7 cow tails. So she opens up the suitcase and she gives a shriek. She says, this is yours, sir. So, okay. So that's, so those are Cyrus, which the parashas are wrapped up with. And the Zohar says that those Cyrus should protrude between the compartments of Shema and Vahayim Shemaya. So that's a Zohar. So it's difficult to say that it's ma'akev because it's not a halachic basis. It's a kabbalistic inyan, but it's certainly something that should be there. And if the Cyrus, al pi the Zohar, should only be one. Our minig is to have multiple Cyrus sticking out. But if there's nothing sticking out, so it should be. I'm not saying you can't make a bracha on such tefillin, but it should be repaired. As far as the shel yad, the cover on the shel yad, you want to know about whether you need it. So you do need it, because if you don't have it, what happens? The tefillin shel yad are an ois between yourself and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So therefore, they're meant to be covered. Tefillin shel yad is supposed to be covered, as opposed to the shel rosh, which is megula. Sfaradim, al pi Kabbalah, some of them cover the shel rosh also, but the shel yad certainly should be covered, which means that you should pull your sleeve over the shel yad. Now, if you don't have that cover protecting the shel yad, what's going to happen is, over time, your shirt, eventually, like with Rabbi Akiva with the water, your shirt can wear out the corners of your shel yad, and it can cause problems. Especially a lot of people's shirts are very tight, and you really have to pull it over the bias. So that's why that thing is there, to protect the shel yad. Now, in previous generations, when they made tefillin from dakais, so it was mamish, if you didn't have that cover, you had to get a new pair of tefillin pretty quickly. Even with the cover, when they used dakas, they got tefillin pretty often. Knows today, a person buys a pair of tefillin, he expects to use it for many decades. In those days, they bought new tefillin all the time, because with dakas, the tefillin got ruined very quickly. They were obviously much less expensive also. So today that we have gases, it's not as much of a concern, but it's worthwhile ensuring that the cover is there. Now, there are those that have a minhag to take the cover off when they make the bracha. This minhag seems to originate from the Chazon Ish. The Paiskim don't really understand why there's any need to do that. But if one has difficulty taking it off, then one can really be getting into a shayla, because then it's like a tzipui on your tefillin. So some say that the inyan is to take it off when you make the bracha, just to show that the tefillin are the tefillin and not the cover is not the tefillin. Others say that then you're getting into an issue, because then you have to put the cover back on and you have to pull down your shirt before you put it on the shel reish. You're getting into a shayla of a hefsik. Most people don't take it off when they make the bracha, but there are those that are makbid to do so. Yeah.
Is the inyan to cover only the batim, or the mitzvahs down to the?
Just the batim. Yeah. We still have 2 minutes. Anybody? Okay, so there you go.
Thank you so much.
B'simcha Rabba. Okay.